My name is Stuart Taylor. I want to welcome all of you to the first session in the second week of Francis, a series on Francis, St. Francis of Assisi. Last week we looked at St. Francis as a model for human liberation, and we did that from the perspective of liberation theology, looking at Francis in relation to the poor, St. Francis in relation to the church, St. Francis in relation to suffering. And this week we're going to take a slightly different. So last week we were looking at Francis in relation to some of these critical issues that face us as Christian disciples: our relationship to the poor, our relationship to the church, our relationship to suffering. This week we want to take the entire week to focus in on Francis and creation and his relationship to the created order, to nature. And we're going to do that. We're going to use the tool of one of Francis's poems called The Canticle of Brother Sun. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Does anybody recall hearing about the? So this is what we consider to be, what I consider to be one of the most important dimensions of the witness of Francis, of how he related to creation. Unfortunately, we have to kind of at the very beginning cut through a kind of sentimental caricature of Francis. I mean, we've all kind of grown up with the Francis statuary in our gardens, kind of behind the bird bath and to the left, you know, and we've got this kind of sentimental vision of Francis, that he was tra-la-la-la-la with the birds and the bees, and there's certainly something to the fact, the assertion that Francis was one who exhibited a mystical love for creation. That is certainly true, but we want to look at what was that relationship that Francis enjoyed with creation, and how did that relationship with creation impact his relationship to God, and vice versa. And we'll use this poem of Brother Sun, The Canticle of Brother Sun, and we'll look at that, and I'll also have copies for you that you can take with you. I didn't want to use those just yet for a reason that I'll go into. Basically, I want us to kind of begin by grounding ourselves in the reality of our creation at this moment, which in a word is one of crisis for people of conscience and faith. That as we look around, we read the papers, as we look at our own communities, we see signs of an immense ecological crisis, if not happening, impending. And I want us to kind of, as a group, to begin to name some of that, to talk about what are some of the signs of our time in terms of the ecological crisis. Just in a kind of brainstorm fashion, let's name some aspects of that crisis without a whole lot of explanation or correction from anyone. Let's just name some of those things that we face.
Greenhouse effect.
The greenhouse effect. What else?
Ozone layer.
Could someone help me with a little scribing up here? Would someone be willing to do that? Oh, okay. Thank you. Oh, good. Great. Greenhouse effect. Ozone layer.
Geometric population growth.
Explosion in the population growth.
Landfills. Garbage landfills
here?
Are filling up.
Yeah, that'd be fine. What was that? Landfill?
Garbage landfills are filling up.
Landfills. Okay.
Destruction of the rainforest?
Destruction of the rainforest in South America. And what does that do? Why does that concern us? We're literally, we're almost asphyxiating ourselves. Other aspects are?
Acid rain and sterilization of lakes.
Acid rain.
Pollution of the ocean.
pollution of the oceans.
The decay of the human environments, especially urban environments.
The decay of the inner city, the urban environments.
Mass extinction of other species.
Okay, animals are going extinct, other species.
Smog.
Noise pollution. Okay. Others.
Toxic chemicals. Water, air, food.
In our food, in our air.
What? I got, oh, we're...
It's okay.
Do the same thing.
You're doing great.
All right.
Others.
Soil erosion.
Loss of the land.
Destruction of watershed.
Destruction of watersheds.
Disappearance of wetlands.
The disappearance of wetlands, you can just put wetlands up there. Wetlands, there you go.
Pesticides.
Timbering, the whole timber controversy right now. We drove through Northern California and Oregon on the way here. Old growth forests. Cutting down trees, the old growth forests. So I think by your participation in this exercise, there's some sense that we are in fact in an ecological crisis. We are in fact in a time in which our environment is almost experiencing rupture in its ability to maintain life. If we were going to spend a lot of time together, if we say had a week, we would need, I think, to go through a process of analysis for each one of these and talk about the political systems and the economic systems that are a part of each one of these problems and analyze those at depth to find out who benefits, who pays the cost, who are the beneficiaries of these systems that are depleting our environment and raping our environment. That would be very important for us to do. And there are classes here at Holden that you can take where you can wrestle with some of those questions. And this week that we're going to have together, for those of you who come back, we're going to have a much more limited scope, but a very important question that we're going to try to wrestle with. We're not going to look at the economics or the politics or even the cultural issues behind this ecological crisis. We're going to look and try to wrestle with the basic question of what is the spiritual root cause of this crisis in our environment, in our world. And I wonder if anyone might risk throwing out their opinion or their belief about what is the spiritual root cause of this crisis?
Greed.
Yes.
An early church's distrust of nature.
A mistrust of nature.
Alienation
is another way of talking about our relationship to nature or to the created order.
A mechanistic view of the world.
Using a kind of the same thing, using other things as objects. just objectifying things.
Basically, it's always comes down to a false vision of who we are as human creatures, as men and women. And it seems to me that our traditions in the church, in Christianity, have been very much involved in distorting that image or that vision of who we are, or at least those traditions have been distorted. We think of immediately what comes to mind is the creation story in Genesis. And somehow we have taken that translation from the King James of, and man was given dominion over creation as some kind of license to master and to manipulate creation as if it was something we owned. It was our property to do with as we wanted to use it as a means to any ends that were ours. And somehow that, when we get at our very basic stories that define our identity, when that kind of distortion occurs, it creates an image of ourselves as somehow standing above or beyond nature. We were talking about the alienation or the mistrust of nature. We even see that in our doctrines about salvation. Somehow salvation has come to mean in the Christian church that our souls at death escape their bodies and go off. The true self, the spiritual self, goes off to be with God, and abandons the finite and the physical, the less than eternal physical world. Somehow we've gotten away from what Paul surely held as the salvation drama, which was the liberation of the whole creation, the resurrection of our bodies with the whole of the created order is renewed and transformed and liberated from death. This idea of souls popping out of the world to go to be with God is really not the Christian notion of the afterlife. What Paul teaches, and what I think is much more central to the gospel, is that the whole of creation groans for liberation. You remember that passage in Romans where it talks about the whole of creation waits eagerly for the freedom of the children of God. The whole creation awaits its liberation from decay and death. And that's the only way in which it seems to me that salvation ultimately can be understood, is it's the liberation of the whole of the created order and reunited with God in the final moment of history, and that finally creation and creator are reconciled, and we experience salvation as creatures within that context, but not simply as souls that go flying off, abandoning, in a sense, creation because it's somehow less than real or even evil. And we have some of that in our tradition, that what's really real is the spiritual, and what's really not real is the physical. And yet the Hebrews, the genius of the Hebrew Bible is that it holds that body and soul are a unity. And I think this is something that Francis recovers in his celebration of creation. So our task, it seems to me, let me just check, is it anything, did anything I throughout there, did it strike up anything in you?
Well, in the early church, I always thought that the attraction of the church for the underprivileged people was that they were looking forward to this life to come. So how does that fit in with your theory that we're going to be liberated? How are they going to be liberated in the creation?
Well, I guess it's the question that I hear you raising is the quality of Christian hope. What is it that we hope for? What is our ultimate destiny? Where is history moving? And I think it is not the full expression of Christian hope to think of that hope as kind of an escape in which I am popped out, my soul goes to rest with God. It's the full hope of our Christian faith to say that all of creation is moving towards some ultimate reconciliation with God. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Our own feeling about television advertising makes people want to own more things, and that in turn has an effect on cutting down trees, for instance.
That's right.
And explosion of population, the people are demanding more and more to be happy. The television puts forth that we should own more things and travel more to be happy. And the acid rain comes about because of airplane effect on the atmosphere. And so progress made through television has a bad effect in some ways.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think that nice that Dan just walked in, because this morning, Daniel's class, we were talking about how you just brought up the fact that In our culture, we often see the spirit world or the spiritual as what's good and to be achieved, and as what's real, and the environment and what surrounds us is somehow kind of tainted and bogged us down. On the other hand, this morning we were talking about how what our rational mind considers only what's in front of us as real and good, and we've cut ourselves off from a spiritual side of life. Not the way, so is there.
I think that alienation that we're talking about from the created order occurs in a number of ways. There's the, and I think what you're pointing to is the much more common experience of modern men and women, that we have we're in such a technocratic culture that values our ability to manipulate the environment and come up with scientific solutions or technological solutions for every aspect of our life, that we are, in effect, distanced more and more and more from, we think, from the reality of the created, of creation. So I think you're very right to point out that it's not just today's malaise is not just a spiritual attempt to escape the world, though we do have that too, but the more common problem seems to be a technocratic, rationalistic distancing or alienation from the processes of nature. So that's a helpful correction.
Well, that, but I'm still a little puzzled because I want to hear what you think about that, and maybe Dan too. If in fact, because we've been suggesting this morning a little bit that we've cut ourselves off from the spiritual side of life because we focus so much on the material. But then on the other hand, we're cut ourselves off from the material world as well.
So well,
do you feel it?
What?
If I could just mention that this, what we are committed to do is closer to this is technocratic, technological, rather than, I think there's a real spiritual connection to creation.
I think the common point is we have a false vision of ourselves when we think somehow that we transcend nature, that we stand beyond or above the created world. And we can do that either through a rationalistic technological mindset or worldview, and we can do that either with a spiritual ideology that somehow says the things of the earth are less important than the things of the spirit. So in either case, we have an attempt, a human project, to distance ourselves from our relatedness to creation. So what we're going to try to do, I hope, that, yes ma'am?
Well, I was going to say, you know, when I look at creation, I think it's a reflection of God. When I look at people, I see people as reflection of God. But as we look at nature, we can say maybe this reflects our understanding of God, the order, the abundance, the beauty, the generosity.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm just coming up with a partial list, but we can say, well, if God created this, this must be what God is.
Exactly.
And so we're looking at it a little bit differently. And I know sometimes that when I need to feel the presence of God, that being outside gets me out of my self-centeredness mm-hmm. and into that feeling of abundance and celebration and riotousness, and what you need is there for you, and this peacefulness, and this everything is working so beautifully.
Well, that's precisely what we, I hope, will be our task this week, is to reconstruct a spirituality that is based on our connectedness to creation, rather than our distance from creation, or our transcendence over creation, our solidarity with the created world, with the material physical universe, and to rebuild our spiritual foundations on that basis. And I think Francis is a wonderful rabbi for us, or a teacher, because of his witness and his example and his how he related to creation. What we've done all last week in introducing the sessions, we would use a little bit of Francis's biography as kind of a springboard for our own theological reflection and our kind of discussion of some of these critical issues that face us as Christian men and women. We'll do something of that today. I want to just tell you or offer a couple of the stories that I really treasure, or just maybe kind of paint a picture of Francis and in relation to creation. And if you can think of stories yourself, please offer those. First of all, Francis lived in a part of Italy in a time. The province of Umbria was a few steps away from a wilderness. It was a beautiful, rolling land. Wasn't developed that much in terms of agriculture it is today. There were city-states spread around it, like Assisi and other cities. But in between those city-states were these long rolling hills and mountains, craggy mountains with lots of caves and boulders, and there was a lot of waterfalls flowing obviously over these mountains. And so Francis grew up in this kind of environment, which he was constantly taking long walks and excursions out into the countryside and spending days, literally he would disappear for days even before his conversion experience, in which he would just be hiking, taking a walk. He loved the light. He loved the light and the way it played off of the physical environment. He loved the different shades of light during a day, and he talked about this a lot. He loved the sound of falling water, the babbling that we can of water that we can hear as we sit beside a creek or a river. Francis had a strange rapport with animals and wildlife that I can't quite come to terms with. It's hard for me to know where fact ends and legend begins, and I don't know where to draw that line. It's the more I read of Francis, the more I begin to, as a modern person, kind of doubt my doubts. Particularly as I read of how other cultures and men and women of other cultures and other times have had a different kind of way of relating with wildlife. You know, in fact, I'm taken back by the fact that deer wander through the village, you know, and even a bear last week was wandering through the village. So my sense of the distance between human creatures and the other creatures is something that I'm kind of looking at. And so with Francis, I'm more open than I thought I was to the stories we hear of how birds would come and light on him and eat out of his hand and listen to him. And he would actually have conversations with them, actually preach to them, to the birds. The same kind of stories about fish that would and also the famous story of the wolf of Gubbio?
Gubbio.
Gubbio. Jan, why don't you tell us that story?
Oh, well, it's fairly simple, but I'm sure everybody knows it. That there was a wolf that was caused wreaking havoc in the countryside, I imagine from the area you were describing, and that it was killing livestock and people, I believe, according to legend. And Francis was called in as a holy person who might be able to find a solution to this. And that he reached a pact with a wolf, whereby the wolf agreed not to do any more damage if the people would feed it, which seems a pretty common sense solution to me. But anyway, that is in fact what apparently transpired according to the legend, that the people fed the wolf and the wolf stopped causing damage to their livestock and community. Oh, I don't know. Does the legend tell us what they fed the wolf?
Porridge.
Yeah.
So beyond the dichotomy between fact and legend, stories like this tell me that indeed Francis, there was something about Francis's being that allowed for a greater intimacy between himself and other creatures, other wildlife, and that perhaps some of the stories are exaggerated, but perhaps not. Who knows? But there is a truth there in Francis's relationship to wildlife and to the created order. As I mentioned, the thing we want to use as a guide for us this week will be the Canticle of Brother Sun, and many of you have heard of that. This poem was written at the end of Francis's life, and after enduring a period of intense trial and controversy and conflict, in which the order, which had rapidly grown to hundreds and even thousands, I'm not sure about thousands, but certainly hundreds of brothers who were spreading across Europe, and there were intense discussions about the nature of their life together and the way their disciplines were going to be lived. And Francis was struggling with this and feeling a lot of pain about that. His health was breaking down. He was almost blind. In fact, it's kind of one of those remarkable paradoxes of Francis that and throughout his life, that at the moment in which he was almost blind, when to look outside on a sunlit day caused him excruciating pain, he could at the same time write Canticle to Brother Sun. This poem came to him in a moment of inspiration near the end of his life, and we can see the spiritual fruit of an entire lifetime written into this poem. And for those of you who decide to come back for succeeding sessions this week, we're going to try to look at the different archetypes of creation that are mentioned in the poem. Sun, moon, moon, wind and air, water, fire, earth, and death. So that's kind of an overview of what we're going to be doing. But I'd like for us to kind of begin, if we're ready, to look at this poem. Can all of you read it? Are you able to read it from where you're sitting?
A little light on the blue.
Would someone who has a good view of it, would you two do a reading for us? If you would take one line, and then you would follow, and then alternate between the two of you and read the canticle to the rest of us. Is that all right? You up to the task?
Most High, all-powerful, all-good Lord, All praise is yours, all glory, all honor, and all blessing.
To you alone, Most High, do they belong. No mortal lips are worthy to pronounce your name.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through all that you have made, and first, my Lord, Brother Sun, who brings the day and light you give us
through him.
How beautiful is he. How radiant in all his splendor, of you, Most High, he bears the likeness. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister, moon, and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright and precious and fair.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through brothers, wind, and air. And fair and stormy, all the weather's moods, by which you cherish all.
Open up the night. How beautiful he is, how gay, full of power and strength.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through Sister Earth, our mother, who feeds us in her sovereignty and produces various fruits and colored flowers and herbs.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through those who grant pardon for love of you, through those who endure sickness and trial.
Happy are those who endure in peace. By you, Most High, they will be crowned. All praise be yours, my Lord, through Sister Death, from whose embrace no mortal can escape. Woe to those who die in mortal sin. happy those she finds doing your will. The second death can do no harm to them.
Praise and bless my Lord and give him thanks and serve him with great humility.
Admirable job being put on the spot like that.
Thank you. Well, let's just kind of start looking at this. What strikes you about this? What kind of jumps out at you as you look at the Capitol? What are some of the obvious things about structure or form? Or,
yeah. He's a feminist, way ahead of his time. He talks about sisterhood and mother. It's not all key.
So the designation of a brother and sister. There are two aspects of that, I think. First, that the fact that he personalizes nature in a sense. He speaks to nature as in an I-thou relationship. So there's part of that. There's a kind of the reverence of a thou that's inherent in nature.
It's only those last two lines that he speaks to us, isn't it?
Very important observation, and let's come back to that. Hold on to that, and we'll come right back to that. That's an important point.
You give him thanks.
Right.
He makes it like a family, too, like he's a part of this family, his brother and his father.
So if you have brothers and sisters, by implication, there's also father and mother in this family. So the sense of the profound sense that Jesus had of Abba, Father. This, I think, we can also read into Francis's spirituality, a sense of the parenthood of God, the fatherhood and the motherhood of God. In the sense that all created things are somehow brother and sister, then there is the God who is parent and creator.
And it starts right off, though, right? Putting in perspective that all the praise is yours, Lord. All glory, all honor, and blessing, and all that we have is still to you alone that they all belong.
And what's that next line?
No mortal lips are worthy to pronounce your name. So is that where you...
Yeah, that next line, yeah. What do you make of that?
Isn't there a... Is it from the Old Testament that you don't know the... No one can pronounce the name of God.
No one can know them. Yeah, not to even use the word Yahweh in certain.
That's right. The Old Testament and Jewish tradition, you do not utter the name of God. It's almost like, as I've worked with the canticle, and it's almost like there are two movements in the poem. There's this vertical movement, which kind of points to the impossibility of really knowing God or expressing God or even praising God vertically, directly to the transcendent creator. But then we have this horizontal version in which praise is just breaking out all over the place through every element of creation. Everything is clapping its hands and singing for joy with the praise of the creator. So there's almost like a direct vertical relationship is almost impossible, or it's impossible to articulate that praise that's worthy of God. But then when we are in solidarity with the rest of creation, that praise, we see that praise is possible through all that God has made. It's almost like a vertical movement that comes to an end and a horizontal movement that opens up again and again wherever we turn. Again.
Well, to... not play a critical note, but it's been fixed up in our hymn book with the phrase "All creatures of our God and King," and I don't know where that got in there because it isn't in this. But this doesn't mention any other creatures.
Creatures, as in
wild. Creatures, as in the things that move around, and I mean, the plant order is mentioned, and Mother Earth, and the sun and the stars and everything, but no other, well, not even humanity. I mean, by implication, this is Francis praising, but what of the creatures of the earth that do you have any observation about that? I mean, why would that, I mean, given his relationship, it seems strange. It seems a strange omission, I guess.
That is kind of puzzling to me. I hadn't quite, it seems so obvious now that you point it out, but I hadn't quite seized on that. But that's an important point. I don't know, perhaps that this poem was dedicated to the inanimate aspect of creation rather than to wildlife and to other creatures. Let's just kind of stay with that, see if we can make sense of it as we go. So there's a sense in which what becomes impossible for Francis on a vertical, in a vertical relationship, is not only possible but pervasive in the horizontal relationship of all of creation singing to the Creator. The first thing you seem to notice was the brother-sister designation, and we talked about how that personalizes the elements and also, in a sense, implies the family of God. What do you feel about the designation of a feminine and a masculine name to certain elements? Does this seem to be, what do you think about that? For instance, does it bother any of the women in this room that, or what does it say to women that water is designated with the designation sister, and fire?
It's the description of sister water, useful, lonely, precious, and pure.
Or that sun is somehow masculine and moon is considered feminine. Is there something we want to look at in that?
That's traditional.
Yeah, I think it's traditional.
Very typical.
I don't think he was the first one to use those designations for those things.
Dan?
Did the language have masculine
Latin.
And feminine?
Latin.
Italian.
I'm
Luna,
sure.
That's a feminine Indian, right?
It does now have masculine. But he was maybe just following the language.
It could be. Yeah. But I think there's something very intentional. It's not just picking up the language of his day. And I think there's a lot implied in the masculine elements and the feminine elements. And it would be perfectly all right for men or women to have problems with that designation, or to...
He had a very nice relationship, affectionate relationship with poor Claire. And with this, very likely, was his way being a chaste member of the order, was one way to express his affection for the feminine.
I think you've hit something very important. We talked about this last week, and I omitted to mention that, Francis in relation to the feminine, and his whole relationship to Claire, the relationship to the feminine within himself as a man, as a masculine creature, and his relationship to Claire and the other order of sisters who stood on their own ground and in their own integrity as having their own vocation with and before God. As equal to his own. So there was a sense in which Francis related in a real way to the feminine. But it may not be a way that we necessarily want to embrace, or we may find that there's some real insight in that. Did I cut you off? Did you want to make another comment? There was another hand.
No. The one that kind of bothers me is the sister earth or mother. Because I think that kind of takes the onus off us to be, well, when you think of mother, you think of caretaker and nurturer, and I don't really see the earth that way, and I think maybe we need to be the caretakers or nurturers of the earth, and I think that female designation is, I just am not comfortable with it.
Don't you like, though, that the earth kind of gives birth to the things of creation names? And to me, that would be illogical.
Well, that part of it is logical, but
I think if you just look at the earth as a mother, when does a mother get taken care of?
That's probably says more about our society
right.
than the designation of
one thing I wanted that I noticed when I look at this is that there's there are almost polarities set up here in which masculine feminine elements go in some kind of union or relationship. So we have sun and moon, we have earth, let's see, I get them all. Can't quite see this as well.
Fire and water.
Fire and water. Actually, I think earth and moon, sun and moon go together. Earth and fire, wind and water, and then we have these last two. So there's almost like marriages or polarities of masculine and feminine. Now we're going to talk some more about this. We don't have to be totally comfortable with these designations or the setup of the construction of these polarities between masculine and feminine, which elements are which. But I want us to be open to these and to dialogue with Francis about what these meant to him, and then to make the leap to what they could mean to us and whether they fit our experience or not. But we'll be looking at each one of these sets or polarities of archetypes, brother sun, sister moon, and so on. Now, back to your point, these last two stanzas don't seem to follow the rest of the poem. They refer to all praise be yours, my Lord, to those who grant pardon for love of you, through those who endure sickness and trial. And then the final stanza, which seems to almost point, he's befriending that which seems to be the contradiction to all life and all of creation, sister death. These two stanzas were in fact added at a later point in his life. These were all written in one flash of insight, and this stanza was added after he had been involved in a peacemaking effort between two factions that were at war within Assisi. And then this stanza directed towards Sister Death was written obviously clearly near the end of his life as his death approached. And here we see that even death receives the designation of sister, of someone not to be feared and pushed away, but someone to be befriended and recognized as an ally and as a bearer of gifts. It's very important that you caught on to that. We also see that all of this is not just nature mysticism, but is very much finally to be brought home into the human world, into the life of human experience. So what we have here in this poem is a celebration of cosmic elements that have their own reality apart from human experience and human spirituality. But also, for Francis, these are symbols that reach to the very deepest of our interior life, of our spiritual lives. And it's important as we work with this throughout this week that we not abandon either pole. This is very much a celebration of the outer cosmos, the world out there that has physical reality. But these symbols also encompass the depths of the human spirit and have an interior spiritual correlation. So that when Francis is talking about Brother Sun, he's literally talking about the sun out there in the sky, and he's also talking about a very important aspect of the human spirit and of human spirituality. And with each of these, and each of these symbols has a different reference point or gets at a different part of human experience. And that's what we're going to try to be doing this week, is to deepen our encounter both with that cosmic element that's outside of us, and in a kind of correlation movement to deepen our encounter with that element within us as an archetype or a symbol of transformation. that's kind of the project we're about here.
I thought that the woman in blue was talking about the last two lines of the book being addressed to the reader. I didn't know that she was talking about the last two stanzas.
Was that right?
I just observed that those two last lines, praise and bless my Lord and give him thanks and serve him with great humility, that's the only part of the poem that, or the canticle as you call it, that speaks to us as people. It doesn't, all, you see, the rest of the canticle is addressed to the Lord. All praise be yours, my Lord. See, he's talking just to the Lord in the whole canticle, except in the last two lines.
Well, I believe the sense I get from the flow of the canticle is that he is celebrating all dimensions of the creation.
Yes.
And how they join together
but
in praise of.
He's admonishing us to in the last two lines.
That's right.
It's an admonishment.
That's right.
To us.
In fact, the last two stanzas actually bring it home to human experience. Those who grant pardon, who endure sickness and trial, and those who face even death. And so, and you're correct, the last lines do. It brings it home.
Yeah. But this starts to make a little more sense, though, because we had the opportunity to visit Assisi a year ago. The brother there that was talking about the life of St. Francis, and everybody kind of expected him to show us the paintings in the cathedral depict the life of St. Francis. And the last one that you see, it's almost apologetic showing of it by the brother, was the one that is so familiar to all of us, of the bird sitting on the shoulder, whatever. He was emphasizing so much the life of St. Francis and his dealing and his humility, his working with other people and whatever, and you know, just deliberately trying to play down a bit of the part that we have kind of glommed onto so much of the time.
I think, yes sir.
We saw the same thing, Giotto's page, Giotto's
yeah, right.
And I think that this was sentimentalizing St. Francis. And I think this is where you went to be
I think that anyone who lived and was as vulnerable to nature in all of its extremities as Francis was could not possibly sentimentalize or romanticize nature. I mean, he was very much affected by all the seasons, by the extremities of nature, by hunger, by cold, by heat, all these things he knew very well, and yet we still have this profound sense of the beauty.
Well, I don't know. I was just going to venture an answer to my own problem earlier, and that we sentimentalize that aspect of Francis because we trivialize animals and other creatures in this world. We have totally trivialized them. We can only deal with them in a sentimental way. And someone over here earlier talked about how we have this mistrust of nature. I think the mistrust of nature is probably most evident in our relationship to other creatures in our environment. And I've often wondered if it came from our Judeo-Christian tradition in which we rejected these nature religions that were often manifested in other animals. And we're just not able to even let animals into our worship. The only one that sort of crept in is the dove by virtue of being a symbol of the Holy Spirit. Other than that, we can't allow animal symbols anywhere near our worship or our expression. And I wonder if this is why even in this, that Francis doesn't talk about animals because of the you know, stigma of association with pagans, you know.
Or the lamb, and we immediately kill it.
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
The sacrificial. One more comment, and I don't want to.
Okay, I was thinking also about what you said earlier, and I had an idea, but I don't know that much historically about it, so maybe you can help. Is that the classical elements of those days were the fire, air, water, and earth. And most of what he puts out there is fire, air, water, and earth. And you said that he's not only talking about the sun out there, but the mystical experience of the sun inside ourselves.
Exactly.
But also, mightn't he be talking about the physical sun inside of ourselves as well as the mystical sun? Because as he saw it, we all of creation was made up of fire, air, water, and earth, and therefore
very
he's only talking about the elements, and those stand for all of life as a given. So he's including plants and animals and humans as being made up of those things physically as well as mystically.
That's a good observation. I've never thought of that, and I think you're right, that basically there was this worldview that there were four elements that made up everything, and so they're our constituents. They're the that's what makes us alive. That's a very helpful observation. I want us to shift. We're running out of time. I feel like a little bit breathless, and I'm sorry. Each of our sessions will definitely have an experiential, more of an experiential component to it than just me up here yakking at you. But and we've kind of gone over a little bit this today in trying to introduce this and get this off the ground. But the last few minutes, I want us to tap that little bit of Francis in each of us. Think about that moment in your own life in which somehow that distance that we feel from nature and from creation was somehow dissolved, if just for a moment, in relation to a pet, in relation to your garden, in relation to a walk in the woods, some moment in which you felt that you were finally communing with the created world. Let's take just a minute to think about that and name that experience, and then I want us just to turn to our neighbor and talk to each other about that.
Well, God gives us things we need.
We're gonna just think in silence for just a second and then turn and talk to each other if we could.
Sorry.
Are we ready? Why don't you just turn to your neighbor, if it's your spouse, maybe turn the other direction. And simply name a moment in your experience, in your life, in which that wall between us and nature seemed to part for just an instant. I'm sorry if we cut off conversations in midstream, and I promise you we'll have more time in the next sessions for this kind of exercise. Let's hear a couple of folks who would like to offer those moments or those, what happened?
We were in Kenya a couple of years ago, and a lion was severely injured by another lion, and this injured lion came right up to our rover within a couple of feet with pleading eyes for help, and you really communicated with that lion.
That's
something you'll never forget.
Wow, that's beautiful. Let's hear just a few more so that we can, if anyone else would like to share one.
Weren't
we've got one over here.
The lion coming
well,
here.
That was in the car.
Would anyone else like to?
I want to hear yours.
Yeah, you can tell I'm dying to tell it. You know, I think at the risk of talking, you know, I thought your comment about how we domesticate wildlife, and I think at the risk of doing that, the experience of pets for me is where we need to begin finding material for a theology of creation. And our relationship to animals that we really love and have are loyal friends of ours that we almost talk to, and we mourn when we lose them. I mean, that for me is the place where I begin to reconstruct a theology of creation. It's the experience of bondedness to my pets, the dogs I had. I remember I was out in a pasture out behind my house when I was in a parish minister in Georgia. We had a big farm I was living on, and we had cows, and my dog and I, my beagle, went out there, and I laid down in the pasture and fell asleep, and I woke up. And my beagle was going like this, just sitting right beside me. I go, what's wrong, Calhoun? So his name was Calhoun.
Oh, no. Oh, Calhoun.
And then I looked and I kind of sat up and we were surrounded in cows. They were just so curious about, you know how curious cows are, and they just came up within 5 feet of us and we're all looking at Calhoun was like, wake up. So that was like solidarity between Calhoun and like, when someone else offer a story.
This side, our older son was in Austria and they had a little BMW bus and they got in late and just pulled over and parked and they didn't know they parked in the grounds of a convent. And so they were waking the next morning surrounded by sisters peeking through the glass.
Same kind of feeling. Yes, ma'am.
We had a blizzard one time and I heard this cat yowling and howling. We didn't own the cat. And our neighbor's cat had brought me a little starving cat she had found somewhere out in the blizzard for me to take care of. And then when she had kittens, she didn't like where they were. The family had the kittens in the grass, there were dogs around. So one by one, she brought her kittens to my backyard, my backyard.
Well, these stories are very important. And I think as you think about and reflect on your own points of contact or communion with creation, that's a very important story to be told, not necessarily to all of us, but for you to think about that.